chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. We really love you.
For the third straight day, thousands marched in California protesting the election night passage of Proposition 8 banning same-sex marriage.
Recently, gay marriage has become the number one issue of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or LGBT community. But should it be? Where is the critical conversation on this issue? I'm Lisa Detmer. In the next hour, we'll hear from a segment of the queer community that isn't so happy with the emphasis on gay marriage. And we ask, what are the other issues some queers would like to see focused on instead?
If we as a movement are not going to be fighting for housing and jobs and food and the basic essentials, healthcare for people, then I'm not sure what we stand for as a movement.
And so it annoys me when people who are promoting the marriage agenda try to use us, use disabled people with AIDS and poor people and, you know, those of us who are really going through these real life critical struggles.
The bar patrons who rioted in Greenwich Village after a routine police raid on a gay bar, the Stonewall Inn, in June of 1969, could not have known that their wild insurrection would enter history as the birthday of the gay liberation movement.
40 years ago, queers rioted against police harassment at the infamous Stonewall Rebellion, igniting the U.S. gay and transgender liberation movements. One cannot help but wonder, what happened to the radical spirit of Stonewall that fought against the everyday injustices experienced by most queer people? Now, gay marriage has become the predominant issue in the LGBT community, drawing hundreds into the streets.
Hey! We do not discriminate!
No one hates! We do not discriminate! No.
But is today's gay marriage movement really like the queer liberation movements of the past? Recently, in California, LGBT groups spent over $43 million to oppose Proposition 8, which outlawed same-sex marriage. But when $85 million was cut in AIDS funding in the same state, the queer response was basically non-existent. The issues of the past, those that affected poor and disenfranchised queers, no longer seem to be important.
So a lot of you know that this is actually part of a big movement right now. This is part of the biggest gay rights movement we've ever seen in the world.
Yeah.
And you are part of that?
During the heat of the battle against Proposition 8 in California, I attended a large and spirited demonstration for lesbian and gay marriage rights in Oakland. It was an emotional rally with stirring speeches. But there among the handheld signs proclaiming marriage for all, I felt out of place. This is my queer community. But I didn't feel like I belonged. I don't want to get married. Could I be the only queer person who didn't feel marriage was important to my life? And I wondered how it was that gay marriage came to be the primary issue for my community.
We're all Americans. We all deserve equal rights. And that's what we're here for, to talk about the equal rights and celebrate our diversity.
Turns out, gay marriage isn't the most important issue for my community. In fact, according to a recent Hunter College study, the majority of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT people, actually see economic discrimination as the number one issue in their lives. I visited my local lesbian and gay center in Berkeley, California, and went to a gay senior event to find out what other LGBT folks were thinking about the gay marriage movement.
There are other issues, I think, that are affecting me more immediately than marriage ever will. I would much prefer, like, not being terrified of getting beaten up or something. Like, there's a lot more issues that I would prefer addressed.
I don't hear the gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender community thinking about the issues of seniors' lives. For example, the issue of healthcare, the issue of affordable housing. As we age, most of us are living on very limited incomes. I received an email from the Courage Campaign and asking us what issues they should focus on. I looked at the list of five issues, There was not one thing on that list that affected me personally. There was not one word about seniors' lives and the needs of seniors who don't have a lot of money.
I think the campaign for marriage equality is very white, very Eurocentric, especially with the fact that it did get passed and both the Black and Latino communities were demonized by saying that they were the majority of voters voting in favor of it, when in fact Black and brown people are a minority in the state of California as far as voting. And I feel like in my experience, there's been a lot of like tokenizing. Oh, like, yeah, we do people of color work. We have this one Black person working here and they talk to Black people kind of thing, as opposed to like everyone working on their issues and like white people checking their privilege.
I want to know from the gay community, what's going to happen after gay marriage? Okay, we get these rights to marry. What about all the discrimination that happens internally to people of color, to trans folks, to young folks, to elders? I feel like gay marriage is a way for people with privilege to gain more privilege and almost forget about the people who are still struggling.
James and I are both on disability programs. We're both disabled people with AIDS.
That's Brian Basinger. His story is one example of how some queer people continue to struggle for basic economic needs. I talked with Brian at his home in San Francisco, where he lives with his partner, James. Both of them survive on the money they get for their AIDS-related disability.
I actually washed the dishes today.
Yes, they were. There was a sink of dishes, wasn't there?
My dishwasher is
broken. I'm on a program called SSDI, and he's on a program called SSI. These poverty programs are very strict, and they don't let you have any money. And so they want James to live on $845 a month, and my income from Social Security disability of $1,300 a month would have disqualified him from SSI because it's a poverty program. You're not allowed to have anything in order to qualify for that income and also for the health insurance that's attached to it. So if we would have combined our households through gay marriage, then my income, they would have said that my $1,300 no longer makes him impoverished. And then he would not have qualified for his SSI anymore because my income, my $1,300 would disqualify him for his $800. And then he would have also not gotten the Medi-Cal health insurance.
Even if Brian and James wanted to get married, they couldn't, not without losing their disability support. And their story is not unusual for queer people with AIDS.
And so it annoys me when these people, when people who are promoting the marriage agenda, try to use us, use disabled people with AIDS and poor people, and you know, those of us who are really going through these real-life critical struggles, to advance what is really a set of benefits that are not part of our reality. There is nothing about gay marriage that benefits my life today. It has nothing to do with me whatsoever.
So why is it that gay marriage became such a key issue for the LGBT community? Dean Spade is assistant professor of law at Seattle University. He suggests the way the gay community came to prioritize gay marriage reflects a broader shift in politics by all types of formerly radical political movements.
In the Stonewall period and in the general 60s and 70s social movements, there were a lot of questions being asked about what oppression is and how to solve it. People were thinking about ways that policing in general impacts Black communities in the U.S. and ways that militarism is part of a project of U.S. imperialism abroad and how that reflected in the domestic arena. And then you can see what happens, especially in the LGBT context, as movements professionalize and as upper-class people sort of take the reins and set the agenda, and the shift that happens towards an individual rights framework. And instead, we get this thin, narrow individual rights framework that doesn't deal with people being able to access what they need broadly and what kinds of major structural changes would have to happen to make it so that people have what they need.
Lisa Dugan agrees. She's professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. But taking the trend even further, Dugan points to cuts in social programs like welfare, health care, and Social Security that have been eroding since the 1970s. Those cuts, says Dugan, leave a heavy burden on individuals.
The kind of social supports that were put in place between the 30s and the 70s were eroded from the 80s till now. So if you have fewer benefits provided by your employment and fewer services provided by the state, then who's going to take up the slack?
As a result, the family became both a moral and financial vehicle for survival.
Idealizing marriage is a way of making the institution of marriage seem like that this is the institution where social support should happen. And it's idealized as really the best place to take care of elderly people, take care of sick people, bear the costs of raising children. You know, all of these costs then, as they're cut away from the state and they're reduced in corporations and they're moved to the private household, there's a strong ideological push to make the family and marriage and the private household seem to be the proper sanctified moral and good place to do all of this kind of social support.
One example is welfare. Priya Kandaswamy is an assistant professor of women's studies at Portland State University. She sees how a focus on the family hurts queers in the same way that it hurts other discriminated groups.
And so, you know, in the mid-90s, when the U.S. welfare system was dramatically reorganized, that image of single Black mothers with bad family values was very frequently invoked to justify cutting assistance to working-class people in this country. And so when the same-sex marriage movement takes up the same language of family, right, and the same language of good families are two-parent families, are families that have a certain kind of economic status, they are, I think, implicitly reinforcing our assumptions about what it means to be in a single-parent family, right? What it means to be in a family that is not as economically well off.
Congress has begun holding hearings on the president's new welfare plan. On Capitol Hill yesterday, Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson said the plan puts a new emphasis on marriage.
Children living in single-parent households are, on average, 5 times more likely to be poor, 2 to 3 times more likely to use drugs, experience educational, health, and emotional problems, and be victims of abuse. Thus, it is simply common sense to redirect our policies to encourage the formation and maintenance of healthy marriages.
Encouraging couples to marry is a new role for the federal government.
That's a National Public Radio report from 2002. At the time, the Bush administration was promoting marriage as a solution to poverty. Kandaswamy says the idea that marriage is a solution is nothing new.
The welfare reform law that was passed in 1996 starts with the proclamation that marriage is the foundation of a successful society and goes on then to create mandatory work requirements, to put a lifetime limit on certain forms of public assistance, to deny assistance to certain populations. And I think that that statement, though, that marriage is the foundation of a successful society is often echoed in what advocates of same-sex marriage say.
So when the same-sex marriage movement then starts to come really into prominence in the 1990s, a lot of the rhetoric of saying marriage is so important, marriage is a sign of our full adulthood, marriage is how we show we're responsible, marriage is the key to citizenship, that kind of language adds to the marriage promotion of the conservative marriage movement and ends up promoting privatized marriage, private household as the site for social support to the neglect or disadvantage of collective social supports.
And so when the gay marriage movement uses the discourse of family values, what they're doing is implicitly invoking, right, the same set of ideas around family. And so when one says that gay and lesbian families deserve citizenship rights because they are families that are just like, right, the normative two-parent white suburban heterosexual family, what they're arguing is that other people whose families don't conform to those models don't deserve those rights. And that idea, right, has been manifested in U.S. welfare policy to very violent ends, in fact. And so I think that's a very dangerous claim for the marriage movement to make.
Okay. You are listening to Beyond Gay Marriage, a look at the mainstreaming of the gay movement. I'm Lisa Detmer. Many of us who donated money to fight for gay marriage were unaware that domestic partnerships, which already existed in California, were created to have the same benefits as marriage. But groups leading the fight seem to have known all along. Kate Kendall is the executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights.
There are very few actual formal legal differences between domestic partner benefits and the protections that couples get under state law from couples who are married under state law. There are differences in terms of long-term care insurance and a couple of other things in terms of taxes. The biggest differences are federal benefits, which are huge and significant. There is no doubt that in this culture, marriage and the status of marriage has a number of intangible benefits and recognition, commonality, a sense of a common and shared language and vocabulary that domestic partnership doesn't have.
What are these intangible benefits that made marriage so important to fight for?
The most stark differences are that when a couple is married, everyone in the broader culture knows what that means. But when you're registered as domestic partners, people do not have an understanding or a familiarity with that status. And it's that second-class sort of treatment that couples get that is the most significant difference.
I remember in the 1970s and 80s when, as feminists, we were fighting for the right for our female friendships to be valued and for a new definition of what family is. Today, people live in all kinds of family relationships, especially queer people who aren't married and don't have children. Priya Kandaswamy says for these reasons, it is dangerous to talk about marriage as the only way that relationships and families are validated.
In other words, when we say that marriage is a human right and it is fundamental to our existence, like, what are we saying about people who don't want to get married or people who aren't married or about families that are not organized through marriage? Arguing that marriage is a human right elevates marriage over all other forms of relationships. Similarly, the idea that marriage is the foundation of a good nation, I mean, sounds a lot like conservative family values discourse. The Christian right is constantly invoking the idea of marriage as foundational to the family, as foundational to the nation. So it is striking when gay and lesbian organizations start to use that same language. And it really, I think, says a lot about who they are trying to appeal to and who they see their constituency as.
We are in the midst of profound change for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Americans. Carrying on the legacy of leaders before us, today, the Human Rights Campaign is at the forefront of this movement to make the dreams of equality a reality.
That's a 2008 video from the Human Rights Campaign's A Year to Win. Images of diverse and historical radical queer people and social justice activists like Harvey Milk, Audre Lorde, and Martin Luther King Jr. appear. The Human Rights Campaign, or HRC, is one key national organization that put gay marriage at the top of their agenda. And their choice affects the agenda of the entire gay rights movement.
I mean, I would say that the landscape of LGBT organizations is pretty polarized.
Again, Lisa Dugan.
And there are national organizations which have prioritized marriage equality, which are basically organizations that are structured around private fundraising, right? They don't have constituencies. They don't have, they're not grassroots. They don't mobilize. They raise money in order to either lobby or litigate. So I'm talking about HRC, Lambda, the equality organizations, and those are the organizations that are making the decisions about national policy, and they tend to be dominated by prosperous white people.
On the other hand, Dugan says, there are grassroots organizations that have a different structure and different politics.
Then there are lots of grassroots organizations, and they tend to be local. Here in New York, we have the Audre Lorde Project, we have Queers for Economic Justice, we have Fierce. We have organizations that are much more democratic in their decision-making structures, that are predominantly people of color, or else they are significantly people of color. And those organizations tend not to prioritize marriage. Right, and to prioritize a range of other issues around poverty and racism and immigration and health care and retirement and violence on the street and things like that, rather than marriage, the military, and representation in the market.
One of these more grassroots organizations is Queers for Economic Justice in New York City. It's a nonprofit that promotes economic justice in the context of sexual and gender liberation. Kenyon Farrow is their executive director.
The effect of gay marriage on the rest of us who are working on other issues in queer spaces is huge. I mean, there are funders who, you know, want to fund and only fund marriage or people working on access to military service or any of those number of things. The way it usually gets framed to us as grassroots organizations is, well, we don't know what impact you're really having or what impact you're really going to have. So if you're not working on a very kind of specific and narrow policy change, but you're doing more work that's actually building a grassroots base to do organizing and among marginalized queer communities, like, you know, Queers for Economic Justice and working with a lot of queer and trans homeless people for whom the groundwork to do that kind of organizing and advocacy or even creating sort of policy solutions that folks are interested in takes a much longer time.
Many people believe the gay marriage movement has taken funding away from other critical needs for queer people. From 2004 to 2008, Leslie Ewing worked at Lying Martin, the only freestanding community clinic in California that works specifically with lesbian and bisexual women and trans healthcare.
I would talk to donors who wrote big checks to national organizations, and I would explain why it was important that we keep our clinic doors open for poor lesbians and transgender people who, you know, wouldn't be able to go to the doctor otherwise, their doctor would be San Francisco General. And on more than one occasion, I was told that I made my choices early on, and I decided that I was going to work hard and make sacrifices and get a job that gave me good benefits. And I am enjoying the fruits of my labor and my decisions. And these people, or those people, have made their choices. And unfortunately, if you don't work hard, you don't get health care. I would walk away empty-handed practically. Well, most of the time when I talk to people like that, I would be dumbfounded. People who have homes, people who have inheritance, people who are concerned about property values are writing the checks to keep this issue on the front burner.
In the meantime, many people are concerned that the mainstreaming of the gay community has severely impacted the services provided to people like Brian Basinger and his partner James.
The gay marriage movement took the air out of the AIDS movement, as well as the funding. So while we as a community were fighting for gay marriage, Governor Schwarzenegger decimated the State Office of AIDS funding for AIDS.
Brian Basinger is not only a California resident, he's the executive director of the San Francisco AIDS Housing Coalition. They are one of the few groups left in the AIDS field in San Francisco that works with homeless and low-income people with AIDS.
When I heard that $43 million was spent on Prop 8 to pursue such a narrow agenda for such a small part of the population that would benefit from it, I was livid because at the same time, they're cutting $85 million in HIV/AIDS care in the state of California. They eliminated funding for housing, and that's housing residential care facilities for the chronically ill. That's for seriously ill people. And so over here, they're trying to talk about those of us who are ill and in vulnerable places as their slogans.
Basinger's partner lives with life-threatening problems from AIDS. So the idea that gay marriage is a central issue on the gay agenda deeply troubles him.
There's a mythology that people aren't dying of AIDS anymore. But the reality is that AIDS is still the number one cause of premature death of gay men in San Francisco. It's still killing us. Here in San Francisco, almost 90% of new HIV infections are in what they call men who have sex with men. The overwhelming majority, and even a super majority, of people with HIV and AIDS in San Francisco are living in extreme poverty. There's this mythology that gay men are wealthy. The reality is that gay men are twice the national average to live in poverty. We are poor. Poor people see that this pursuit of gay marriage as really a middle class and an upper middle class issue.
And by the way, as California goes, so goes the rest of the nation. It's inevitable. This door is wide open now. It's going to happen, whether you like it or not. This is the future, and it's now.
In March of 2008, in my home state of California, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom stood on the steps of City Hall and congratulated the people of California for their victory. The state Supreme Court had ruled in favor of gay marriage. Proposition 8 later overturned that decision. But at this moment, the cause was celebration. Many queers in the state, even those pleased with the ruling, were a little baffled that gay marriage had become such a major issue. I visited the Housing Rights Committee office in San Francisco. Tommy Avicola-Mecca, the committee's volunteer housing coordinator, told me the groundwork was laid during Gavin Newsom's 2003 run for mayor.
So Gavin Newsom runs for mayor, and he runs on a platform, an anti-homeless platform, Care Not Cash. And what one of the first things he does is he does this whole gay marriage thing. He was pressured by the gay marriage folks, basically to do something. He didn't respond to them. So the way I understand it, his people basically, the people surrounding him, who were, you know, a reasonable number of white gay men, gays, obviously said to him, Gavin, you lost to Castro because your opponent won the Castro. Now, it would be interesting if you did something, you know, to win back the Castro and win back the gay vote, which is very strong in San Francisco. So I imagine that was his motivation, really, in doing the gay marriage thing. I also don't think that he thought that it was going to get the kind of publicity it did or that it would become what it became. But it would make him a hero in the eyes of people he wanted to be a hero in the eyes of. Instead, it made gay marriage into the issue and the only issue for San Francisco queers.
Avicola-Mecca says he thinks other issues like homelessness are clearly more important.
If you do any work at all with homeless people, you see that there are a large number of homeless folks who are queer or transgender. A lot of people with AIDS who are homeless as well. I think nationally, the statistic that was recently done by the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force in conjunction with the National Coalition on Homelessness found that, 45-50% of homeless youth in America are queer. In San Francisco, the number is usually considered to be about 30%. Now, those numbers are way above what's believed to be our percentages in the population, i.e. 10%. And that's scary. That's scary to me. And I think that should be a wake-up call for our movement. But it hasn't been.
At a 2010 hearing with San Francisco's Government Audit and Oversight Committee, scores of people testified about their experience as homeless queer people in the shelter system in the city. The hearing lasted more than 2 hours.
Hi, my name is Anak Sewell, and I am in my 14th month of being homeless in San Francisco. I've been here for 3 years. I moved here from Texas to get better HIV care, and in general, being LGBT, I don't have family that cares for me, and I'm looking for it here in San Francisco. When I was staying in the shelter at MSC South, I was assaulted verbally by a gentleman repeatedly calling me a fag. When I walked to the floor monitor and asked them to handle it, they just shrugged, and I was very upset. It just made me feel extremely unsafe knowing that there's nowhere you can go to if somebody is verbally assaulting you.
And the issue of queer homelessness isn't just important in San Francisco. In New York City, there is also no queer homeless shelter. Joseph DeFilippis is the former director of Queers for Economic Justice in New York City. He told me about their struggle with the shelter system and the Department of Homeless Services, or DHS.
Folks with domestic partnerships were not being granted access to the family shelter the way folks with marriage licenses were. And so we had to fight with the city for 3 years to get them to change the policy to have DHS treat domestic partnerships as if they were marriage licenses. We did it in partnership with four other organizations, a couple of which were rather mainstream LGBT organizations that we dragged into it, and they were very supportive, proud to say.
After 3 years of negotiation, a compromise almost passed that would have marginalized straight homeless people. But DeFilippi says they were ultimately able to get what they wanted.
And it took us an extra year. But in the end, what ended up happening was we got what we wanted. Domestic partnerships for gay and straight folks are sufficient to get them into the family shelter. But in addition, the definition of a domestic partnership was expanded so that you don't even have to be in a conjugal relationship. It could be an uncle and a nephew now using a domestic partnership to access the family shelter. And that's a win that I'm really proud of, because we could have taken the short-term gain, which is what our movement does all the time, and gotten a win for a very specific small set of people. Or you stick the fight out a little longer and you get a much broader win for a lot more people. I see that as, for me, as a real learning moment around the limitations of the gay marriage argument that's going on right now, which leaves out so many queer people and queer family constructions that don't fit into the gay marriage agenda.
Of course, many LGBT people do want equality and are actively fighting for gay marriage. Andrea Shorter is the Deputy Marriage and Coalitions Director for Equality California. She says that marriage is very significant to her on a personal level.
It's really about potential. See, I believe that when you are holding people back and you keep them in a state of a second-class status, we know that through history, through human history, that we lessen people's opportunity to really give of themselves and really be a full partner in our communities. If I get up every day, I go to work, I pay my taxes, I should be able to go to the clerk's office like anyone else in a city hall and with a woman that I love and say, we are ready to make a contract, a commitment. And as citizens in the state of California, as citizens in the United States under constitutional law, I should be able to do that.
And other people at pro-gay marriage demonstrations agree with Shorter, especially when it comes to race.
We, gays, blacks, Latinos, all of us are protected under the same law. Don't let them put us against each other.
I know that one of the perceptions of the issue of marriage is that it's a luxury issue for white, you know, gay folks and middle class, upper middle class folks. I don't agree with that. I'm an African American lesbian, but I am aware of the perception. I'm also aware of the perception that sort of predominates popular notions of who is LGBT. And what I mean by that is that, again, it's mostly gay white folk.
But other queer people of color see it differently. Kenyon Farrell from Queers for Economic Justice says the issue of gay marriage is a luxury issue that focuses on one segment of the gay and lesbian community, people who already have lots of access.
You know, the segment of the gay and lesbian community, if you will, who already have so much access, already own property, already have some established wealth or ways to gain wealth, that marriage becomes the final sort of hurdle to their becoming sort of fully white and enjoying all of the privileges that, you know, white supremacy has to offer.
And for others, like Joseph DeFilippis from Queers for Economic Justice, it is the mainstream LGBT movement who was fostering the image of the gay movement as white and middle class, because that serves its own interest.
In the 80s, there were these surveys done of gay magazines like The Advocate, and they found this information out as a result of the surveys of the readership that has been widely circulated for 20 years now, which is that we tend to be white, double income, no children, with disposable income. And the fact that women weren't subscribing and trans folks weren't subscribing and poor people weren't subscribing is completely lost in this mythology. The mythology was put forward by our movement, by our leaders, because they were trying to flex this newfound political muscle that they were developing. And as AIDS had mobilized many people in our community, this became a tool with which we could go to politicians, go to corporations, and say, you better pay attention to us and our needs. We vote, we shop, and we have power. And so it became this myth that has become internalized and has been used against us, frankly, by the right, which has characterized almost all of our battles. They've characterized it in the work they do as a bunch of spoiled white privileged people who already have lots of rights, and why are they fighting for special additional rights? And nowhere in these discussions were a butch black dyke who just got out of prison and is trying to find a job. That is not how our community is depicted. The most that is depicted with regards to poverty in our community is the issue of young people being kicked out of their homes for being queer or running away from home because they've been abused.
Some in the same-sex marriage movement admit that gay marriage does not benefit all queers, especially those who are single or without property. But they argue that raising the issue of same-sex marriage has helped make all gay issues more acceptable and has helped reduce homophobia generally. But others disagree. Again, Joseph DeFilippis.
When homophobia is your only target, then the removal of homophobia will only benefit the people for whom that was the only issue facing them. If you're homeless and you're a person of color and a person of color who's an immigrant and you're queer, getting rid of homophobia tomorrow doesn't change the immigration battles you have or the racism that you have to contend with or the struggles to pay for your apartment.
And it is unclear that the gay marriage movement has really led to greater acceptance, as some people claim.
If you look at it generationally, you look at the attitudes of 20-year-olds around gay people versus 60-year-olds, it's just a cultural shift that is happening. And to credit it all to gay marriage, I think, is ridiculous. To say that it helped expedite it a little, probably, but that doesn't justify the huge resources that have been poured into it, the ways in which other much more life and death issues were utterly ignored. It doesn't justify any of that in my mind.
For DeFilippis, fighting only against homophobia is not enough, and in some ways, it is racist.
I would say absolutely the mainstream gay movement is racist, and I would say that racism takes many forms, and sometimes you are aware you're being racist, and most of the times you are not, and that institutional racism is much more potent and deadly than some individual person using some racial epithet, which is what they hear when you say things like they are racist. They think it means you're calling someone an a**. And in fact, what it means is that you are completely ignoring their lives, their issues, their agendas, and you're taking money away from the funding of their lives and issues and agendas to focus it on yours, which you perceive as being much more important. You perceive it as the real work and not all of this extra stuff on the side, which is how our work is often dismissed. And I would call that racist, yes.
Lisa Dugan argues that beyond the stereotypes, there's reasons to believe fewer queers of color are even looking to get married.
The majority of the LGB population are unpartnered, the majority, more than 50%. But white and wealthy gay men are the most partnered population in California. And, for instance, black lesbians are the least partnered and the most likely to have children. But if you were looking at that data and you were trying to think, what do our constituencies really need, marriage would not be at the top of your list.
And other queers of color, like Kandaswamy, say a large percentage could not get the material benefits gained through marriage for a whole host of reasons.
There are certainly queers of color who are interested in marriage and who, as individuals, would benefit in certain ways if they were given access to the institution of marriage. However, I think if we think structurally about the rights that people might get through marriage, these rights are incredibly racially stratified. So, for example, we can think about property rights, right? There are queer people of color who stand to gain from the property rights that marriage would bring them. However, right, the allocation and organization of property in this country is still really racially stratified. And the same is true for healthcare through a spouse's employer. While certainly some people of color might gain healthcare through a spouse's employer through marriage rights, it is in fact true that that far more white people work in jobs that provide healthcare through an employer than people of color do. So if people of color, right, sort of disproportionately don't get healthcare through their employer, then people of color are disproportionately not going to benefit from the right to healthcare through a spouse's employer.
And, you know, this is part of this theory that what the law says is what matters, rather than whether or not people have what they need to survive.
Dean Spade.
If we were really concerned about the survival and basic needs of queer and trans people in California, our top priority would have been dealing with the immigration issues and the violence against queer and trans people in immigration detention in California and the violence against queer and trans people in the massive criminal punishment system in California. But that's not what the goal of this supposed movement is, right? The goals of the marriage campaign are very narrowly about this formal legal right, and the people who are the most vulnerable are communities who could really stand to have some much more urgent life and death issues dealt with, are really basically left out of the picture, and those issues don't get the attention or the resources.
It's the campaign for legal equality, like marriage equality, that Dean Spade says end up reinforcing those divides among us.
But as wealth inequality worsens in the United States every day, right, and as the racial wealth divide grows, so many people aren't going to get all those benefits from it. So what you get is a community divided, right, along lines of race, class, immigration status, all those things. And so you have a agenda that's going to benefit the people with the most privilege, and the vast majority of people are not going to get what they need from it and are starting to be left in the same position or in a worse position because they don't even have solidarity with other people in their community anymore.
That's true for Brian Basinger and many other queers with AIDS who won't be able to access any of the benefits of marriage.
Because even though there are 1,001 benefits of marriage, what they don't talk about is the fact that if my lover and I had not unregistered our domestic partnership, we would have lost our health insurance. And so disabled people with AIDS are forced into a position of choosing between our health insurance that keeps us alive and those 1,001 benefits of marriage. And I'm here to tell you that there is no choice, that gay marriage is not something that is accessible for the overwhelming majority of disabled people with AIDS in the state of California. And so it's a basket of rights for those people over there. Meanwhile, we're sitting here fighting for our lives and trying to get a roof over our head.
You are listening to Beyond Gay Marriage, a look at the mainstreaming of the gay movement. I am Lisa Detmer.
In California, the liberal uproar over the passage of Proposition 8, the ballot initiative banning gay marriage, that uproar continues. The big controversial finger-pointing part of that uproar is the fact that African Americans, who turned out in much larger numbers than in 2004, voted in favor of Prop 8 by a 7-in-10 margin. So the state and the country is left to grapple with the question of what it means for civil rights. That the same voters who disproportionately helped elect the country's first African-American president also disproportionately helped to take rights away from the gay community.
Even liberal media programs like the Rachel Maddow Show racialized the way gay marriage was banned in California. However, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force released a study days after the vote debunking the myth that African Americans overwhelmingly and disproportionately supported Proposition 8. But Kenyon Farrow from Queers for Economic Justice wasn't surprised by the initial hostile response in the gay community towards African American voters.
I think it actually shows that there's been a longstanding sort of tension in the white mainstream LGBT community and a certain hostility to the African-American community who they feel should automatically support their particular political platforms, though they have shown no historical interest in issues facing African-Americans in any, you know, real or organized way. I think the tensions and the things that are being said, I think it reflect, A, the amount of racism in the white LGBT community, and then two, things I think that people have been holding their tongues to say or felt that they couldn't say for a long time, and now they feel empowered to do so.
Farrow says the media has generally excluded voices critical of the mainstream gay agenda.
I think that the media, both the, you know, sort of mainstream media, as well as a lot of, you know, even progressive or more independent sort of left media, very much bought into the platform of the mainstream gay rights movement as it was, and didn't really offer a lot of critique of that movement, nor even offered space for different voices within a more broader, you know, LGBT or queer community, people who were dissenting voices about marriage, about access to military, and so on and so forth, to even have any space to discuss their particular oppositions to some of that movement. And one of the sort of most recent examples was on Democracy Now! Back in October of 2009, you had Lieutenant Choi, who's become one of the sort of main faces of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell issue as a person who served, gay man serving in the military, you know, who has been vocal about needing to drop the ban on gays serving in the military.
Our country slaps us in the face and orders us don't ask and orders us don't tell. Well, I am telling you that the era and the time for asking is over. I am not asking anymore. I am telling. I am telling. I am telling. Will you tell with me?
West Point graduate and Iraq War veteran Lieutenant Dan Choi. He's facing discharge for the military for revealing he's gay. He was among tens of thousands who marched in Washington, D.C. Sunday for gay rights. He'll join us today to tell his story.
When I saw the Democracy Now! Piece, I was incredibly disturbed. I mean, I almost couldn't believe that, you know, given, you know, again, what Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Represents in terms of media on the left, that they would actually have Lieutenant Choi on and let him again kind of, you know, have the floor to talk about gays accessing the, you know, military and dropping the ban without any sort of critique. So there's a way in which I think both the mainstream media and certainly, you know, and progressive media have often just sort of bought whatever the sort of mainstream gay rights arguments are in a way to sort of appear, I think, not to be homophobic, but really haven't worked to find or to promote sort of dissenting voices within LGBT or queer movements.
If gay marriage is not the most important thing for the majority of queer people, what is?
In terms of issues that are important to me that I think, you know, would go a long way to protecting the lives of queer and transgender folks, I absolutely think housing and the issue of homelessness and poor and low-income queer folks is a huge issue for our work. I think that violence and doing anti-violence work is a huge issue. And I would also say HIV/AIDS is still a huge issue, and probably actually more broadly, what does the healthcare reform package mean for the LGBT community?
I think that if mainstream lesbian and gay organizations are interested in working towards racial justice, then they need to take on racial justice issues. So, for example, they need to take on racial injustice in the criminal justice system and think about the fact that people of color are incarcerated at, including queer people of color, are incarcerated at incredibly high rates in this country. They need to think about racist immigration policy. They need to think about racial disparities in economic security in this country. And I think that that's what it means to care about racial justice. And it's not about bringing a few people into an organization to represent the interests of queer people of color. It's about being willing to do political work that betters the lives of queer people of color in all of the dimensions of their lives.
And so every time we turn around, they're cutting, cutting, cutting. And so if we had taken those $43 million that were spent on the failed Prop 8 effort and really invested them in a broader social justice movement, an LGBT social justice movement that looked at all of our needs, then we could have prevented new HIV infections, especially among young African Americans, and we could have sustained a change for all kinds of vulnerable people.
What's needed instead are other kinds of retirement supports and health care and access to drugs. And, you know, there are a lot of other things that people need. If you're talking about the youth population or the aging population, or even if you're just talking demographically about what seems to be the majority of the population, it doesn't seem that marriage rights are, in material concrete terms, the most pressing thing for most of the population.
Lisa Dugan is also part of an online group called Beyond Marriage that advocates for recognizing a greater diversity of households and partnerships.
We want domestic partnership and reciprocal beneficiary for members of our community who don't want to or aren't in a position to marry. We don't want health care and social security allocated through marriage. We want universal benefits.
Instead of marriage, Lisa Dugan says the concept known as reciprocal beneficiaries is a better way to imagine legal partnerships.
So that, for instance, the great thing about reciprocal beneficiary is that it allows you to have a partnership with someone with whom you do not claim to have a sexual relationship, right? It could be your best friend or your sister. And you could then get next of kin recognition or certain kinds of tax rights if you were economically intertwined, or perhaps like a Golden Girls household, right, could have the way that they actually are interdependent recognized for purposes of medical decision-making and taxation and things like that, that a reciprocal beneficiary as a form that actually exists in several states, that form of recognition really takes the regulation of sex away from the state altogether.
Even Kate Kendall, who fights for gay marriage with the National Center of Lesbian Rights, says that marriage shouldn't be the only way relationships are protected.
You shouldn't have to get married to have your relationship protected, and you shouldn't lose benefits by getting married. The ideal construct, from my perspective, would be to have marriage have less of that psychic cultural importance. Have it be a religious ceremony for people who want to have their union solemnized in a church, but for everyone, gay, straight, older, younger, poor, rich, if you want to have legal entwinement with each other and obligations, your domestic partners, you're in a civil union, your reciprocal beneficiaries. But as a lesbian legal advocate, until we have an equality of systems available to all, marriage is how we best protect couples in this culture. And until that changes, that has to be a fight.
Brian and his partner are two of the people that the mainstream gay agenda leaves out. And their issues are literally a matter of life and death.
Our basic human rights are being violated in such fundamental ways. And then they're spending all of their money for these very esoteric, sort of higher level efforts at they're calling it a civil rights movement, but you know what? You can't have any other kind of civil rights if you don't have a roof over your head. And how dare you stay silent on that? And how dare you not devote resources, an equal share of resources, to help people who don't have a place to live? They don't have a place to go to the bathroom. They can't shower. There's no place for your medication. You're getting beat up on the streets. If you're going into a shelter that they're targeting you for violence at night, they're ganging up on us. And it's not once, it's not twice, it's over and over and over again.
Although gay marriage is still the issue that most of the media and mainstream voices from the LGBT community continue to amplify and highlight, there are plenty of queers who are challenging that agenda by dedicating their lives to issues that affect the poor and disenfranchised members of our communities.
This is a moment where the agenda may be changed, but it won't be changed by the organizations that are pushing the mainstream agenda. I actually think that they are, and they have painted themselves into a corner because they've been so narrow in their focus. And from everything I hear, from talking to civil rights organizations, to economic justice organizations, to labor movements and what have you, they have succeeded in actually ticking off a lot of organizations. People have felt very used by many of the mainstream organizations. And as soon as the mainstream organizations got what they wanted out of them, they walked. Said that they wanted to build bridges and work with, you know, civil rights or organizations and communities of color, with labor, with, you know, women's organizations, all of whom I've heard a range of things from lately, who've all felt that the mainstream LGBT organizations approached them, got what they wanted, and then they walked. And they never got another call again about anything that the other groups on the other side wanted and needed their support around. So, you know, I think it's a good time to sort of strategically begin to build better relationships and relationships of integrity with those kinds of organizations that are interested in working with queer organizations, but have been, quite frankly, burned by the mainstream agenda. And I think we can begin to, at that point, advance a different kind of queer agenda.
Hundreds of other queer activists and scholars are dedicating their lives to making our communities more inclusive to queers of color and women, homeless and imprisoned queers, and queers with AIDS, and to making the whole queer community truly part of our family. While we may not be that visible, we continue to fight for this vision just beneath the radar. This radio documentary was produced by Lisa Detmer and Elena Botkin-Levy, edited by Andrew Stelzer, with recording help from Chris Thomas and funding assistance from the Estrella Foundation and Making Contact at the National Radio Project. To get more information about this issue, you can go to beyondmarriage.org or check out Queers for Economic Justice in New York City online. And to hear this documentary again online, you can go to kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. To contact me about this radio documentary, you can email me at lisadetmer@yahoo.com. I have been your host and producer, Lisa Detmer.